Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Guaranty Trust Holding Company PLC's full year 2022 investors and analyst conference call. All participants will be in listen-only mode. There will be an opportunity to ask questions later during the conference. If you should need assistance during the call, please signal for an operator by pressing star and then zero. Please note that this call is being recorded. I'd now like to turn the conference over to Mr. Segun Agbaje. Please go ahead, sir.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you very much for signing in. On the call with me today to help, maybe shed more light on things, you have Miriam, who's the MD of Guaranty Trust Bank. You have Banji, who's the Group CFO. You have Kelvin, who runs the funds management business. You have Eddie, who runs Habari, and Tom, who runs the PFA. I will basically be anchor and answer what I can. Where I can't, I will ask one of these people to help me. We have had the presentation online for about 2 and a half days now, so we won't be making a presentation. We'll be going straight into questions and answers. Thank you again for signing in and calling in. Yeah, let's start with the first question.
Thank you very much, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star and then one on your touch-tone phone or on the keypad on your screen. If you decide to withdraw your question, please press star and then two to remove yourself from the list. Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star and then one. The first question comes from Ronak Gadhia from EFG Hermes. Please proceed with your question, Ronak.
Good afternoon, Segun and team. Thanks for taking the time and my questions today. My questions are really twofold. I guess we're entering in a period of uncertain times with the new regime coming in. Maybe could you just talk us through about some of your base case assumptions on some key economic indicators, like inflation, exchange rate, interest rates, you know, what you expect from that and what potential impact that could have on the business? The second question is on the non-banking segment, particularly the payments business. Could you just share what some key KPIs are? How many merchants do you have on that platform? How many banks are you clearing for? You know, what we should generally expect from this business over the next 3-5 years. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ronak. What I'll try and do, I'll try and expand a bit on each question so that hopefully I'll take some of the things other people are thinking about. Like you said, in terms of what we see, we definitely have a new government coming in. What do we see? Let me start with foreign exchange. What you basically hear, if you listen to all the candidates who campaign as well as this president, is everybody talks about convergence. We'll all have to figure out what convergence means. Does it mean 650? Does it mean 700? Does it mean 750? One thing I'm clear about is that convergence means we will have a devaluation, whatever that is and wherever it ends up is, what we plan for and what we're stress testing our balance sheet and our capital for is a devaluation. In terms of interest rates, as you started to see, one-year bills were like 14.7, yields about 17. We think you're going to start to see a move upwards in interest rates going towards inflation, which is about 21%. I think once you start to do this, there will be a tempering of inflation. We don't see a runaway inflation. I think once you see a devaluation and you look at interest rates. We have looked at these things in terms of a couple of things, our loan book, our capital ability, and we feel pretty comfortable. If you have a long position, means you will add something to your profits and to your retained earnings. We will, however, also look at certain impairments that might run through the balance sheet, and it might be an opportunity to take it. For us, normalizing of macros, which is what we would like to call it this year, is positive for the bank. In terms of the subsidiaries, let me start with, I will start and end up with Squad, which I think, or Habari, which you know, people are a bit curious about. First of all, as you can see, all the non-banking subsidiaries are P&L positive. You have our funds management business that did a profit of about $275 million, went from about $27 billion in management to $108 at the end and growing. I don't want to spend too much time on people asking me more questions. Maybe later I'll shed some more light. In terms of the PFA, it's growing as well. We are not that bullish on what you call AES. We're at about 59 at the end of the year and growing. AES for us is merely wholesale, and we'd like RSAs, which we believe are more sustainable and kind of retail. And if we hit somewhere around 100 billion in AUM this year, we're happy. In PFA, sorry, in funds management, if we kind of get to about 250, I think we've done our work for this year. Now, in terms of Habari, as you've seen, and he did tell everybody we were going to be very transparent with Habari and that we were going to publish the figures. Habari did 926 million. I know that a lot of the fintechs are very concerned because we don't see their own figures. The profitability of Habari is actually a very easy thing to understand if you understand the business model. The business model for Habari was never to burn equity to gain market share. The business model of Habari was always to put something together where the company could pay for itself. And that's what you've seen in the first 6 months of the year. The money has come from really three, four different things. One is what we call value-added services, which is basically airtime and SMS. In terms of airtime, Habari is doing about $12 billion a month, and in terms of SMS transactions, about $540 million. Also, the capital of Habari is intact, so we have investment income. And then we're also then making money from online, offline acquiring, which is growing. The first quarter is actually much better than what you saw at the end of the year. So we are ramping in terms of online, offline, and switching. We're approaching $500 billion a month. The aim is by half year to make sure that the online, offline, client switching business covers the expenses of Habari completely. So everything we get from investment income and from investment income and value added services will go straight to the bottom line. And we are very optimistic we'll achieve this by half year. So, yeah, that really is the Habari story. But if you would like a bit more, want me to shed a bit more color, I'm very happy to.
No, thanks. Thanks for that, Shaggy. Just one quick question also to add. What's the? Can you give us an update on where the securitization process is? It seems earlier in the year there was some momentum towards that securitization process, but things have died down since the election. So maybe you could just update us where the process is and what that could mean for your NIMs. Thank you.
Okay. Well, honestly, we haven't heard anything about securitization, but again, that's a potential upside. Because if we're asked to sterilize our CRR and our sterilized CRR and put them into ways and means type bonds, then it can only be better for us. The CRR ends zero, special bills earn 0.4. So if that does happen, that's just another upside for the second half of the year. But there hasn't been any real talk or traction that I would say is meaningful enough for me to comment on.
Okay. And what would your SFCRR be? Let's assume, you know, the minimum cash reserve requirement is 30%. What's your SFCRR about that level?
Okay. We're $1 trillion. $1 trillion is about 36%. So our SFCRR must be somewhere around about 40 or 400, I think, because we're 36% CRR, so we would be doing about 4% on a trillion. Would be excess for us. Over 32. Even though we have notice that not every bank is within that 32.
Okay.
Ronak, do you have any further questions?
No, that was it from my side. Thank you.
Thank you very much,
sir.
Thank you. The next question comes from Timothy Womble from APSA. Please proceed with your question, Timothy.
Thank you. Thank you, Shagun and team. Thank you for taking time to answer. My first question is with regards to Ghana, and just to understand from the presentation, the impairment on the Eurobond, is this only one Eurobond, the one that missed the payment in January or February? Kindly just touch on that, and maybe just shed some light on the private sector lending performance in Ghana. Should we, are there lingering concerns with regards to asset quality? The second question is on your NIM outlook. It appears modest from my perspective, given that it's lower than your FY22 guidance. Maybe speak a bit further into that, why you're only guiding at 7%, lower than the 8% you had originally guided for FY22. And then lastly, so in response to the potential removal of the subsidy, we've seen the FG look to propose an increase in the civil servant salary by up to 40%. I just want to get your sense on whether the private sector will be looking at something similar, you know, just to pick your brain on that. I don't know that you've given it much thought. I'd just like to get your view on that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Simple answer on Ghana impairment is we took an impairment of 30% on all the euro bonds, irrespective of which one. And for the one we held in Rwanda, we took 45%. Asset quality, we don't have a lot of issues in Ghana in terms of asset quality, about 3% NPLs. We were very conservative, and if you look at our loan to deposit ratio, it's about 28%. So we really don't expect a lot will happen to us in terms of asset quality. The problem we've had in Ghana, and that's why we put the slide in, we're very transparent about it, is, you know, rather unfortunate, we weren't reckless in Ghana, but all that was based up on sovereign debt. NIM's guidance, you might be right, we might have been a bit conservative. It's from the fact that we were flat 2021, 2022 at about 6.6. If we do see some yields pick up, it's not impossible we'll get the NIMs to 8. But again, it will depend how much CRR is being taken off us and how much special bills. Because if you look today, 56% of our LCY deposits is based in special bills and CRR. So that really, really mutes what you make in terms of your NIM. But if there's less of that and there's an interest rate pickup, I think the NIMs at about 8 are not an impossible target. Look, in terms of really what's going to happen in terms of subsidy removal, your guess is as good as mine. First, I think subsidy removal is a very delicate issue, and we'll have to see how it be handled. If you remove subsidies, then if the subsidy is removed, then I think generally we're all going to have some wage inflation, because especially for those who are lower down the inflation and those who you might not consider professional staff, you will actually have to increase their salaries, and you might see a bit of wage inflation in the second half of the year if there's a subsidy removal. I don't know if I answered your question.
Yes, you did. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. The next question comes from Oluwaseun Arambada from FBN Quest. Please proceed with your question.
Hello. Thank you for hosting this call. Just a few questions, and the first will be around your loan growth policy. I remember in previous calls, you have talked about, you know, much of your loan growth coming from your Nigerian business, and then, you know, maybe not so much of a compelling reason for an aggressive loan growth in other markets because of the higher yields you're able to, you know, get from fixed income securities in those markets. But with the Ghana situation, how are you rethinking your loan growth policy? Are we going to see, you know, stronger growth numbers than what we saw at least for last year going forward? And also in that same line, when you say higher yields in other operating markets, can we know which markets exactly, you know, we are now looking at, if that is still the story for this year? Something else in line, asset quality. I would appreciate an update on your ITO exposure. And I also recall you know, I think that was at the H1 call you talked about, you know, WAMCO undergoing a restructuring. So I would like an update on that. All right. Secondly, on your non-interest income line, I saw about 800 million, an income of about 800 million in under asset management income, and that was non-existent in the previous year. Could you just shed some light as to, you know, that income? For your payments business, last conversation was that Habari was about 0.3 to 0.4% of group and that you had a target of 1%. Would appreciate like a progress report on that end. That would be it for me. Thank you.
Okay, let me start from the last one since I didn't have a chance to write it down quickly. As you can see, as at the end of 2022, the SOBs, the non-banking subsidiaries were about 0.8 of group. So what I said about Habari is odd. We're at about 0.3. We're hoping that at about 2023, the non-banking subsidiaries will give us 2%. And if you look at the figures, like I said, first quarter, we're pretty optimistic that we're on track. Now, let me now, our funds management, which you've spoken about, those are just our fees for our assets under management. As you can see, we've gone from 27 billion to 108 billion. So, you know, I'm not the expert, but depending on whether you have a mutual fund or you have own funds which you're managing in a proprietary way, that's the income we've earned from it. As we showed in our presentation, that's on 108 billion assets under management. In terms of loan growth, Nigeria is still where the loan growth is going to come from. Obviously, we're always very careful even about loan growth in Nigeria because we still believe the challenges in the environment. The loan growth is what dictates what we do in terms of deposits. So you see that we didn't meet our guidances for both is because one pulls the other. There's no point us going 25% deposit growth if all we're going to do is park it in CRR or special bills. So we grew the deposits 12%, we grew the loan book 5%, basically Nigeria, because that was what we saw in Nigeria. We were being a little careful. In terms of Ghana, we're not going to change. Obviously, any country that is defaulted in terms of sovereigns means you have a harsh operating environment. And if you go out and book loans aggressively, you're just going to pick up NPLs. So what we're doing in Ghana is we're not going long. Even when we go investment securities, we're going treasury bills. They also have like 14-day placements, which is what we're playing. We're not going to, because of yields coming down, going to a loan book, because you can tell the environment, what we have, inflation at about 40-something percent. I'm not sure that's where you go and grow a loan book. High yields. Everywhere we're operating, we're seeing higher yields. Even countries like Kenya, which historically, in terms of fixed income securities, were low yield countries, are up. So as inflation is up, we've got to take up the, we can basically take advantage of the yields in those countries. The only thing we have to do better in those countries is drive our low cost deposits so that we have enough scale to go into that. But nothing's changed. We're not going to be aggressive outside Nigeria on the loan book. And even in Nigeria, we're going to be very cautious. Yeah, the restructured loans, IT and WEMCO, they're still there. We're battling them. These are our own restructured and forbearance loans, which are about 280 billion, which is about 16% of our loan book. There has been progress. When you're dealing with so many banks and one customer, we all have little things we want to see in the restructure. So I wish I could tell you that we are finished. But the good thing about all this is that I think the central bank is watching very carefully what you're doing with this forbearance loans in terms of how much dividends they approve for you, so that even if we all don't get out of all these forbearance loans, we would have built up the capital and equity to deal with. I hope I've answered all your questions.
Yes, you did. Thank you so much. Just a follow on to, you know, okay, to that. So, can you hear me?
Yeah, sure, I can.
Okay, yeah. So just a follow on. So in my thinking, right? So you said the focus would be on treasury bills, play more probably in Ghana, you know, and then you're probably looking at higher yields in markets like Kenya. To my mind, does that not mean that, you know, we can expect to see some form of margin compression in 2023, if you're still going to be conservative with your loan growth in Nigeria, and you're opting for shorter term instruments in Ghana. That's just my thinking. I also know what you think.
No, absolutely not at all. Because remember when Rona spoke, if you look at Nigeria, the yields on your fixed income is going up. Your 1 year should have a yield of 17%. We're all going to have to move our loan book pricing. Our loan book yield for last year was 18.8. We're definitely going to better that this year. The fixed income portfolio was 5%. We're definitely going to better that this year. So, no, you're not going to see margin compression in Nigeria, which is easily going to be about 65% of this year's profit. In Ghana, might we see some margin compression? Possibly, but we'll try and make it up in terms of the size of the balance sheet and the size of transactions. The other countries, no. In fact, it's going to be the opposite because your fixed income portfolios are going to give you better yields. So I actually think you will see better NIMs in 2023 than we saw in 2022.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you. The next question comes from Muiwa Oni from SBG Securities. Please proceed with your question, Muiwa.
Good day, everyone. Thank you for the presentation and thanks for that. Just to confirm with my head.
Sorry, Muiwa, your voice is, the thing's fluctuating, so it's going in and out.
Oh, okay. Is it any better now? Still.
Unfortunately, we still can't hear you clearly, Muiwa. If I may just ask if you could please just disconnect and reconnect and then just check your connectivity and then we will come back to your question if that's okay. In the meantime, we will move on to another question. The next question comes from Damilola Ulupona from Chapel Hill. Please proceed with your question, Damilola. Damilola, you may proceed with your question. If your line is muted, please unmute your line so that we can hear your question. Unfortunately, we cannot hear anything from that line. We are going to move on to the next question. The next question comes from Abdul Rauf Bello from WSTC Financial Services. Please proceed with your question.
All right, thank you. Good afternoon to the management. My question is a follow-up to the response you gave on loan book growth. So you mentioned that you're very careful about growing loan book in Nigeria because of underlying challenges. So I got that. However, when I look at the data of your peers in the banking industry and the big guys, you see significant loan book growth among those guys. So I just want to ask that, given that you're faced with a similar environment, how would you describe the difference between your approach and perhaps their approach to loan book growth? I just want to get a sense of how others are able to do it and you're seeing something different.
I think you're the analyst, so you're the better person to answer that question. I think it depends on strategy, it depends on your interpretation of macros, it depends on what you see. But one thing I will tell you is that the easiest thing to grow in banking is a loan book, because everybody's ready to take your loans. But you are the analyst, and you have to determine whether we have clear skies or whether you see some bumpy skies ahead. It's just everybody's interpretation of how they see the macros.
Okay, all right, thank you. So just one more question. And this one has to do with the quality of your internet banking services. So very recently and quite very frequently, we get to see a lot of complaints, a lot of dissatisfaction around your internet banking service. And I'm able to say this because GT is my primary bank, and I sometimes know what I go through with the services. So I just want to ask you, what is the reason for these frequent downtimes? Is there a capacity problem, or what could be the reasons for this problem?
Okay, before I give you the reasons, let me apologize to everybody. It's something that we're taking very seriously, and I'll give you the reasons, but I apologize sincerely, and please bear with us. It's a couple of things. I think that our core banking application is not big enough or strong enough for how we've become. And so the architecture we've had to build around it, in my own opinion, is not sufficient to carry us. So what we are going to be here, I think today we might be finalizing the contract for a new core banking application. We will start the implementation of a new core banking application. Under that new core banking application, we will design an architecture that is more agile and allows us to respond quicker where we have problems. Because in IT, there will always be problems. But you have an architecture that's flexible, which hopefully is what we've built around Habari. So I apologize. It is a combination of both the architecture, the infrastructure, and the core banking application. But we will resolve it this year. That we promise you. And we will, even before we change over to the core banking application, make sure the service goes back to normal. So please accept my apologies again.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, just another reminder, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star and then one. If you'd like to ask a question, please press star and then one. The next question comes from Curtis Schacht from Sustainable Capital. Please proceed with your question, Curtis.
Hi there. Thank you so much for making the time. I've just got two questions. My first question is just around your operating cost. Perhaps you can just give me some color around how you're thinking about your employee headcount and your average cost per employee. Just looking at it, it seems, based on my numbers, that the average salary cost has lagged inflation. And then my second question, just on the USD deposits, but it seems there's been quite a steep build-up in those deposits. So I'm just wondering where that build-up has come from and, you know, how sustainable those deposits are. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Let me start with, then we'll go to cost. The USD deposits come from two places. One, your retail deposits, your individual deposits, and I think you'll begin to see what I call rational behavior. If people believe there's going to be a devaluation or whatever, you start to move savings out of local currency. The second place it's coming from is obviously we have oil producers, marginal field producers, and with a higher oil price, even producing the same quantity of oil, they're earning more. So inflows coming into those accounts create a larger USD deposit base. So really those are the two places the deposit growth is coming from. Operating costs, just as I said earlier on in this call, on this call, we think that you will be facing some wage inflation. You will also see that our personnel costs will go up. We are kind of outsourcing a system in terms of IT and IT salaries. There's a lot of attrition around IT personnel, so we're going to have to come up with a system where you will see an increase in compensation. So the short answer is, while you're right that it's lower now, it will not stay there, because we have to deal with a lot of the attrition issues that we're seeing.
Great, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. The next question comes from Josh Arawolo from Stanbic Pensions. Please proceed with your question, Josh. Josh, you may proceed with your question. If your line is muted, please unmute your phone so that you can pose your question.
Yeah, sure. Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can.
Yes,
thank you.
Yes, I can.
Thank you very much for taking my question. Just wanted to speak a bit regarding the loan growth. I know other participants have said it's cautious, but when I look at it relative to the previous years, it is quite constructive. It looks a bit positive. The guidance 15%. So my question really is, if I'm correct about the positivity on a macro front, what drives this optimism? And then two, what sectors will drive this loan growth? And then any other details really regarding why management is forecasting or guiding 15% loan growth would be appreciated. Thank you.
Okay, thanks a lot, Josh. Couple of things. The optimism comes from the fact that I believe that we will have to move in terms of macros. I think we'll have to have some sort of convergence or devaluation, which will help kickstart the economy. I also think that as interest rates are normalizing closer to inflation, where your one-year treasury is 17% against 21%, that there is opportunity to grow the loan book, and that things will generally be better in the second half of the year, and that we will take more of a chance than we have in the past. What sectors do I see? I mean, fast-moving consumables still remains a big sector for us and a high-growth area. We're not going to be aggressive in the oil and gas space. I think we've got our feel of that. We'll do some manufacturing. We continue to like the retail sector. The retail sector also, if you look at what we're doing with SMEs, we used to be at about zero. We're now 3%. So I think those are the places we expect our loan growth to come. Also, a couple of years ago, agriculture, we were zero. We're now 8%, so we'll do some agri. So it will kind of be from those sectors. My optimism comes from the fact that if we adjust some of our major macro indices to what I think we need them to be, then there will be a general tailwind that the economy will see in the second half of the year. I don't know if that answered the question.
Yes, it does. Thank you. Just one more question, if you don't mind. Just wanted to also talk about the fine and the UK subsidiary, right? Just wanted to find out how is management, actually, has that been paid? Is that going to, the income statement, let's say Q1, or is that going to be spread across for the year? Just wanted to see how that was treated. Thank you.
It's been paid. It was paid in 2020. Unfortunate incident. Again, we apologize for it. It was something that happened in 2016, which we thought had gone away. COVID years, everybody went to sleep, popped his head, reared its head at the end of 2022, at the end of 2022. Because we started the negotiation in 2022, even though we paid early in 2023, it's already on the books. I don't want to preempt the first quarter results for UK, but you will see that we are out of the woods. It was paid last year. You will not see it in the P&L this year. And the UK is doing very well. As you can imagine, they're now operating in an environment of 4.5% interest rates, mortgage rates about 6-7%. So the UK is doing very well.
All right, thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you. The next question comes from Katu Arnold Mukura from EFG Hermes. Please proceed with your question, Katu.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, sir, we can hear you.
Hi, Shagun and team. Thank you so much.
Hi, how are you doing, Katu?
Very good, sir. I have a real request because Ronak and I have been doing a lot of work comparing trading income gains across the largest banks. And we've been so frustrated by the inconsistencies in disclosure. As you know, you can imagine, you reported, just over 2 billion in gains on treasury bills, yet you have a competitor that's telling us that they made 214 billion on treasuries. Now, the difference in the balance sheet is not that big. I can't understand why they cannot be some type of industry standardization of how these treasury gains, gains on treasury bills are booked. And I wondered to what extent we could ask you to kind of push either the CBK or with the auditors to standardize this, because some of these numbers just seem so bloated and make it almost impossible to understand even how they make their money. That's my first kind of comment. My second thing is, On the loan growth, by the way, I think the banks that are growing very aggressively in this market are crazy because asset quality must be extremely poor. I couldn't agree with you more. Well said, sir. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Catherine. At least it's good to see you not dancing naked in the marketplace alone, because I do need to be cautious. In terms of trading income, honestly, we've tried.
I really think one of the ways we can all do it is that as investors, we should all write to the Accounting Standards Board and tell them to call off. It really rests with the auditors. There should be a uniform way of reporting trading gains, derivative gains. And I really think maybe if knowledgeable investors like yourself write to the FRC, Financial Reporting Standards Board, or FI, I forget what they're called, and we should complain. We see a standard way where all of us report, and we should conform. It makes it very difficult to compare the results of banks. So I could not agree with you more, and maybe that would be a good place to start, would be my suggestion.
Thank you. So Ronak and I will certainly do that. Because it's
Please. I think we should write them a strong letter. We should identify the areas where we would like some uniformity. And then we should call the auditors. And by the time we audit half a year, we should all be held to those standards.
Done. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. The next question comes from Landry Buluro from Chapel Hill Denham. Please proceed with your question, Landry.
Thank you. Thanks, Segun and team. Quite commendable on your admission that your technology platform wasn't adequate to sustain or to provide the service, given the growth, which a lot of your peers also do admit to that. I didn't get the ITO answer. If you could just provide an update on that. Similarly, there was news last year, early this year, around Aeroton and NNPC. And we're quite aware you're exposed to Aeroton. It'd be nice to have an update if there's been any impact on your books regards to that. There was, and I guess, coming back to the accounting standard that Kato just raised, Q4, $52 billion in valuation gains. Trying to understand what exchange rate you used at the end of the year. And we're aware you're also long on dollars. But that was a big number. For Q4, and you kind of like, if you go on a run rate for the year in terms of what you've been booking for valuation gains, you have had a quite difficult full year result from a profitability standpoint. So it'd be nice to understand what exchange rate you used, and how do you see that, in 2023. DT has been a bellwether stock, struggled, 2020, over $200 billion in PAT. We haven't seen that since. Similarly, ROE above 20%, in the past, I think this past year, he booked around 18% in ROE. How do we see this going forward? And get, GT back to being a favorite stock for investors. That'll be all for me for now. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, Larry. If I was an investor, but of course I'm biased, GT remains probably one of the strongest stocks in this market by the decisions we've made. You mentioned the 2020 results without mentioning the most important thing that happened to those results, which is that we took $35.6 billion loss in Ghana as a result of sovereign default. If you added that back to the performance of 2022 was actually $253 billion, which is 13% up. We believe we have done the right thing and that we have taken the Ghanaian losses in 2022. Our disclosure is always as transparent as anybody's. And so if you look at the investor presentation, we dedicated an entire slide to what our exposure to Ghana was, which was $167 billion. We showed you the impairment on each of those instruments, Eurobond, local Ghanaian CDs, local USD, and treasuries. And we took a haircut on all of them, resulting in a $35.6 billion loss. So for us, it was actually a very good year. And we were our normal conservative self, but nobody expected Ghanaian sovereignty to go bad. So we've taken it, and you'll see first quarter results. I still think this is the best stock you can hold. In terms of revaluation gains, again, we're very transparent, and if you had looked at your investor presentation, you would have seen that the revaluation gains were converted to 461 on a long position of about $1.3 billion, and there you'll get it. And if you have further devaluation, you'll be able to calculate between 461
and whatever the rate is on that day on a long position of about $1.3 billion. It will give you what the gain is. We might always choose to take some of it as impairment because we run a very conservative stance. On ITAIL, nothing has really changed, which I explained to the other speaker. We're also trying to restructure. Hopefully, we're getting to the end of it. You're trying to carry a lot of banks along, along with a customer who has no views on what a restructure should look like. But hopefully we're almost at the end. We don't have an error return issue. The issue around error return is change of operator. Change of operator doesn't affect anything. I think the operator has changed. The operator will be competent enough. The most important thing to us is the oil comes out of the ground. Oil comes into the accounts to service the debt. So we don't really see error return. Three questions.
Great, thanks. Just one last thing on loan growth. Have you baked in the forecast? Is the devaluation baked into that 15% growth?
No, actually, because if we do have a bit of a devaluation and then we get a tailwind from that, we expect we'll do better than 15%. So 15% even, we are hoping will be LCY growth.
Okay, great, thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you. The next question comes from Kareem Sawabini from Moon Capital Management. Please proceed with your question, Kareem.
Thanks for taking my call. Totally agree with Kasa's comments about the trading gains. But I wanted to ask, what has been the focus of discussion with the incoming administration as it regards the financial sector, and what's been the level of openness and transparency between the private sector, yourselves, and the incoming government? And then the other question I had is on the currency, do you see it more of a gradual devaluation or is it a step function? And what are you assuming or what's the embedded assumption in your guidance? Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Kareem. Obviously, I don't think there's a lot of, you have to allow this administration to finish their own tenor before maybe there'll be engagements. If I were to be honest with you, we haven't really built much of a devaluation into the guidance we've given for 2023, because we really don't know. The place we do build a devaluation when we do is when we stress test our balance sheet. So we've done three scenarios. We stress test a $600 rate, we've done a 650, and we've done a 750. And we've tried to see what it will do to our profitability, what it will do to our capital, and make sure that we have enough capital. And I think in our worst case scenario, capital adequacy goes down to about 18%. So in terms of profitability guidances and the guidances we've advised, we really haven't put a devaluation in, but we've done a stress test internally of what a devaluation will do to our capital using those three rates.
Great, thank you.
Thank you. The next question comes from Emele Odu from Bloomberg. Please proceed with your question.
Yeah, I just want a bit more color on what you said about lending operations in Ghana. What was loan growth in that country last year, and what will it likely be in 2023?
Our loan growth was very low. It was probably around 5%. I think we'll still keep it there. My home opinion is that if you're running over 40% inflation, it's going to be very difficult for businesses to make money or pay back loans. So I think we'll remain conservative in terms of loan growth in Ghana. And I would hope that as investors, if you're investors, you would understand why. Because apart from the high inflation, you're talking about a country that has defaulted on its sovereigns and has not even yet given complete clarity as to how it's going to handle all the default scenarios. So it's definitely not a country to be very bullish on in terms of loan growth at this time, in my own opinion.
Thank you.
Thank you. The next question is a follow-up question from Rana Gardia, my apologies, from EFG Hermes. Please proceed with your question, sir.
Definitely not Rana Ghana. just a quick follow-up. You said on the on the extreme scenario, your capital adequacy ratio drops to 18%. Is that before you consolidate your profits or after consolidation?
Go on.
Okay. Just quickly on the second one. You may have mentioned this before, but just to clarify, what's the net long USD position for the Nigeria subsidiary after taking into consideration the derivatives book that the bank holds?
Okay, if I take the positions 1.3 billion is the net long position. In terms of our stress test, in terms of what we've done, in terms of stress testing, it is before consolidation, but we did something that we think is even very conservative. We basically took impairments for all our forbearance loans against the profit before arriving at that capital.
Right.
I don't know if that would be different. We assumed we would impair all the loans where forbearance is on out of the profit from the long position before calculating the capital adequacy.
Right. Okay. And I guess once you accrue the profit, then that capital position then improves.
Yes, absolutely. And also, if the impairments don't happen, then again the capital improves significantly.
Understood. And just also one other follow-up on the cost-to-income ratio guidance of 40%. Does that include the cost of the new core banking system?
Yes, it does. It does. And so we'll amortize that as well anyway. So all will hit us this year would not be that. So it's in there already.
Understood. Thank you.
Thank you, Ronak. The next question comes from Colin Smith from All Africa Partners. Please proceed with your question, Colin.
Good afternoon, Shagun and the team. Two questions, please. Firstly, on the Ghanaian bonds, with the restructuring obviously still ongoing, are you able to say whether any further impairments were taken in Q1? And do you consider the 30% impairments on the Eurobonds to be conservative or not? And secondly, on the GDRs in London, I understand that the GDRs account for around 5% of the total shares at the moment versus around 13.5% when they were floated. And obviously shares can only be moved one way from the GDRs back to Lagos rather than the other way. Could you explain why the fungibility is limited to just one route and whether GT and the relevant authorities would consider allowing movement both ways, at least back to the original 13.5 outstanding? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, on the Ghanaian bonds, we hope that we've seen the worst, but like I said earlier on in the call, even the Ghanaian government has not yet re-engaged on everything other than the local bonds. So we've taken what we think is conservative. We've done 30% on the euro bonds. We think asking for anything else, even asking for the 30%, we think will be a bit ridiculous, but we haven't. But the comfort you will have, or you should have, is that for the first quarter, we're not accruing the interest on all these bonds. So essentially, we've kind of warehoused the interest, and if there are further haircuts, we can always use that to buffer some of the haircuts. But we would be very shocked, actually, if they ask for further haircuts than this on sovereign debt, really. So I think we've been conservative. In terms of the GDR convertibles, we can always engage the government. I think it was done this way because of the exchange controls and the dollar impact of going the other way. So maybe if we get to the second half of the year, there's more dollar liquidity, then we can go back and revisit the fungibility issue. From a perspective of the 5%, though, I'm sure you'll see if you own them that the dividends are paid on time, everything's paid on time. So the only thing is the fungibility. And if we get to the second half of the year and the macros are looking different and liquidity looks better, it's something we can revisit.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, just another reminder, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star and then one. The next question comes from Sadiq Safiriyu from Meristem Securities. Please proceed with your question, Sadiq.
All right. Good afternoon. Thank you very much. Please, can you confirm that you can hear me?
Yes, I can hear you clearly.
All right. Thank you very much for taking my question. So just very quickly, I wanted to ask what your outlook is for your funding costs. So I can see that the funding costs actually increased in 2022. I would like to know what you think about the funding costs in 2023. Also, I would like to know what you expect to drive the PBT for 2023. So following, the two consecutive decline in PBT in 2021 and 2022, expecting a 30% increase in PBT is quite optimistic. So I would love to understand what you think about it. And yeah, that's it.
Okay, Sadiq, I'm going to repeat what I told Larry again. To determine what our growth is for 2023 on a PBT basis, I think it'd be incorrect to think it's a 30% increase. Because if you put back the 36.5 impairment we did for 2022, the PBT was actually 253. So the actual growth would be 253 to 280, which we're pretty confident we will meet. And as we publish first quarter in about a week, you will decide whether you think we'll meet it or not. I will say no more than that. But please do not look at it as a 30% growth. You're really not growing from 240 to 280. You're growing from about 253 to 280 because we expect that we've taken all the Ghana impairments we're going to take. In terms of funding costs, we had about 1.24. We think we can hold 1.24 for the year. We really don't marked increase in MPR going forward. So I think about 1.24 in terms of cost of funds is a good rate to use for 2023. I don't know if I've made myself quite clear on this 30% increase, because I think it's very important that people understand that the 36.5 billion that we took in Ghana was straight to the P&L, and that if you put it back, it was actually a 13% increase on 2021.
So, Dick, do you have any further questions?
No, I do not. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The next question is a follow-up question from Curtis Schacht from Sustainable Capital. Please proceed with your question, sir.
Are there just a question on your return on equity guidance for 2023? Just given that you haven't baked in any revaluation gains, and I'm just curious to hear, what the drivers are, that's causing the increase from 2022 to 2023. I mean, having in the back of our mind, you would have earned an ROE of about 22%, excluding the Ghana impairment. So just curious, what are the key drivers for a 3% increase to 25%?
On the ROE, you're saying, well, we also have left a bit of a tailwind for devaluation, which we didn't put in the other figures. And we figure that no matter how small a devaluation we have, that tailwind will get us there. And so we've kept some of the other parameters quite conservative and left out the devaluation gains from them on the long position.
So if I understand correctly, that's mainly a revaluation gain getting to 25.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. At this time, Segun, if I could please hand over to you for closing remarks due to time. Thank you very much, sir.
Well, thank you very much, everybody who signed in. Hope we answered your questions sufficiently. Thank you. That's about it.
Thank you very much, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude today's conference, and thank you very much for joining us. You may now disconnect your lines.